We hebben ook een huis-Amerikaan, zoals dat heet. Michael Laird is. Michael Laird woont in Antwerpen, keert ook regelmatig terug naar de Verenigde Staten. Heeft destijds performances gedaan na de inval in Irak, nu toch al 5 jaar geleden. Hallo, Michael.
Hallo, Jan. Hi.
It's obvious what this program is going about. It's about these elections.
Yes.
What are your first impressions, your first feelings and thoughts?
My first feelings are mixed, I would say. Relieved, probably more than anything else. I'm not going to say that I'm excited and thrilled, but I'm relieved that we didn't get saddled with John McCain, which would have just been a continuation of the nightmare of the last 8 years.
Yes, more of the same with McCain.
Well, yeah. Mm. So the nightmare is over. Mm-hmm. So that's the good news.
That's the good news.
Yes.
But your mixed feelings about this
Obama
figure?
Well, I'll put it this way. There are many reasons to be very pleased with the outcome, but for me personally, I would say, yes, I did vote for Obama, mm-hmm. but actually the candidate running for president who represented, I'd say, a genuine left point of view mm-hmm. was the Green Party candidate who nobody heard about, Cynthia McKinney.
Yeah.
But I decided... I wasn't thrilled with it, but I decided I really had to vote for the lesser of two evils.
The lesser of two evils.
Rather than the one who I really wanted to...
Now, everybody was shouting, yes, we can, and mm-hmm. change, and so on. What
yes.
have to? What would you have to expect from that? You say he's a center figure.
Well, he's a center figure, yes. So, in terms of yes, we can, well, let's see. I mean... yes, we can, sure, in terms of it is a thrill that we have an African-American all of a sudden who's going to be president. So I think that really is, I'm not going to go so far as to say something to be proud of the way some people are. It's a question of rather there's no reason to be quite so ashamed anymore. It's not quite the same thing as being proud, maybe, but that part's really good. In terms of opposing, you know, the Bush administration and what would have been a continuation under McCain, then it's hard to say. You know, in terms of yes, we can. I mean, on the surface, it appears that, that democracy works. That you know, mm-hmm. people power, people voted, and they voted out a corrupt regime voted for something much more progressive.
Mm-hmm.
But whether or not that's really sufficient, I mean, people spent the last 8 years sort of in a coma, allowing the Bush administration to get away with murder internationally
torture.
And also domestically with situations like stealing 2 elections in a row and...
Mm-hmm.
You know, the horror show we saw in New Orleans with the hurricane. So it seemed quite astonishing, not so much that those things happened, but rather that the American people, instead of saying, yes, we can, you know, oppose these things, they seem to, as you say, just slip into a coma. So now, you know, it's a nice story, the idea that once every 4 years, you know, people mm-hmm. can... enter the political arena and do something that matters, but you know, in terms of yes, we can. I would argue strongly that you know, democracy is a full-time occupation. It's
mm-hmm.
not something you just do voting for, you know, either the Coke or the Pepsi candidate.
Yeah. All right. What's going to happen with the grassroots society who campaigned for Mr. Obama? Now mm-hmm. they are victorious. Huh?
Right.
What's going to happen with them?
Well, that's going to be quite interesting to see. Ideally, sure, the people will feel empowered and they'll feel that that Obama is obliged to live up to their expectations
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the expression to hold his feet to the fire to make sure that he really does come through with what they were putting all their time and energy into.
Yeah.
So And sure, change is possible. I'm probably coming across as too pessimistic. I mean, change is possible. People can, if you don't believe they can feel empowered and do something about it, then there's not much to believe in it at all. But on the other hand, I would say that they're going to be, the grassroots type people are going to face challenges, I would predict, rather soon. That it's not like...
Yes, because already, and it's first all over here in the Belgian media, maybe you can read Dutch, I know that.
Yes.
But in say, conservative newspapers like De Knek and even liberal newspapers like De Morgen, they say already that the current, the incumbent administration, who is now the name game, it's all Clintonians that we see, that we hear of here. What is that all about?
Well, I think that's a fair assessment, actually. There's a lot of evidence. That's not just assuming things, because I think if we just take a look at the people who Obama is surrounding himself with, these are very familiar people in many cases. For example, he's recently announced who his foreign policy team will be. That's not to say that he's already appointed all the cabinet positions and so on, but actually the first thing that the president-elect really needs to do is very quickly assemble a team of advisors who will, you know, help him, I mean, him or her, but, you know, him,
yes,
assemble a cabinet and other important positions. So his foreign policy team that he announced just recently includes, for example, Madeleine Albright, who is Clinton's Secretary of State, the second Secretary of State under Clinton, right?
Yes.
And had also been, the U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. under Clinton as well. And, some of the listeners may recall that when she had been asked about when there was a policy of very strict sanctions against Saddam Hussein's Iraq at one point, that was resulting in widespread health crisis because of an embargo against medical supplies being shipped there, and other types of things necessary for water purification and other essential things for any modern society. So there had been estimates that up to 500,000 children in Iraq had died due to that trade embargo. So, children. So, I'm not even getting into, how many out of the whole population. So, she'd been asked on television at one point in an interview about that figure and if she thought that it was worth it, such a horrific figure for the trade embargo. And she said, quote, yes, it is worth it. Right. So
In terms of foreign policy, there is a lot of talk in first around multilateralism, that this incumbent, the new government, the new administration will be more multilateral according to the Europeans' point of view. Is that true?
To the extent perhaps that, the Clinton administration was more multilateral than the current Bush administration. It depends, what your standards are, I guess. Assuming one would hope that we wouldn't have a worse administration than Bush, although, who knows what the future might bring. If he's rock bottom, then anything looks good by comparison. So, people I've been speaking with have tried to rewrite history and make it seem like Clinton was a wonderfully progressive president who supported peaceful policies around the world and seemed to forget about, airstrikes against Iraq, against Sudan, and of course with the whole unfolding of things with Serbia and Kosovo, the U.S. Going in there. So multilateral, that's hard to say. Clinton was a better diplomat, was better at impressing European heads of state that he could work with them. And I think Obama, I'm not saying he's the same as Bill Clinton, it's too early to say, but I think he would be similar in that regard. Bush is so obnoxious, it's no wonder that people haven't wanted to work with him.
Maybe you know the famous Jacques Brel song, Madeleine et Mon Amérique à moi. And I mean, Mon Obama à moi, my opinion, I see what I want to see in this Obama figure. That's a little bit the feeling that I got with the European point of view.
Yes. Well, certainly, yes.
Because even right-wingers here in Belgium and in all over Western Europe, they like a Democrat.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I mean, it depends. The Democrats in America are, you know, supposedly the liberals. Now, in America, the understanding of what the word liberal means is a little bit different than the understanding in Europe. But actually, I think the European understanding of that term is more accurate for America as well as for Europe, you know, i.e. not particularly left, more of a centrist point of view that mixes some progressive with some conservative qualities, certainly to the left of, you know, of hard right wingers, you know.
Yeah.
But in America, you know, liberal is something that, you know, the Republicans have tried to redefine that word as somebody who's more or less a socialist.
Mm-hmm.
But that kind of rhetoric makes, you know,
literally Mrs. Palin of Miss Palin exclaimed that word, socialist.
Yes, but it would be interesting if she ever bothered to even pick up a dictionary to look up the definition of the word, much less read any socialist theory of any sort whatsoever. I mean, you know, it's similar to during the Cold War, when Reagan would, rant against socialist and communist governments, and the point is, it was abundantly clear that he had no clue as to what any of the theories were. You know, he seemed to think that the worst practices of the Soviet Union were the same things that Karl Marx had written about. So it was, you know, embarrassingly obvious that he had absolutely no education in basic philosophies that you'd think a powerful world leader would be very familiar with, even if they strongly disagree with them, right? And which is, by the way, I would have to say, to his credit, that Barack Obama, one of the surprising things about him is he fully admits to being a well-read intellectual type person,
yes,
which is highly unusual in American politics. It's almost as unusual as the fact that he's black, actually, you know, that he's not, let's say, for example, Clinton, and I think one could rightly criticize Clinton quite a bit, but, you know, you wouldn't accuse him of having been stupid. He was also quite an intelligent leader on one level, but the thing is, his persona was to try to keep that in disguise, you know, like,
yes,
you know, more like the kind of
play
guy,
stupid.
Yeah, exactly, the kind of guy who'd be fun to have a beer with, or,
yeah,
you know, a donut with.
Barky people.
Right, and maybe the fact, I don't know, maybe the fact, ironically, of the color of Obama's skin has allowed him to not pretend to be anything other than a highly intelligent and well-read
and well-educated,
well-educated individual, right? And so that, at least, is hopeful, you know.
Because it's a little bit funny. Paul Verhagen, which is a psychologist who works at the University of Syracuse in the United States, is a Belgian.
Mm-hmm.
Or Dutch-speaking, anyway, he said intellectual is like a bad name in the United States.
Yes.
In his comments on this election.
Well, that's the thing. It's because, unfortunately, just the way the political culture seems to work, there's this idea that anyone who might have a word like intellectual associated with them is an elitist. And there is this idea that, America is a populist country, and that there's no place for elitism. Now, of course, even to say what I just said seems absurd, in the sense that, of course, it's a country run by elitists. I mean, by very powerfully, you know, powerful financiers, people.
Plutocrats.
Right, exactly. So there's a great deal of elitism, but the point is, that's the power behind the throne. And there's definitely this tradition in America that, you know, one has to be, you know, the common man, so to speak. And as you say, Bush probably, on one level, actually does fit that description. And, you know, Clinton did a very good job pretending that he did. Yeah.
What's now the he appoints a lot of Clintonians, let's so to speak.
Yes.
But within the Democratic Party, I understood there is a certain rivalry between, say, Nancy Pelosi, the woman who is not very known in Belgium or in Europe, but is the leadership of the Congress, I think, or
Congress. Yes.
And she's considered to be left-leaning, and they are also what is called blue dogs. Explain that to me. The rapport de force, power within the Democratic Party. Does it work? It is very little known of here.
Well, the thing is, first of all, I would have to say that Pelosi is somebody who, I think, whether or not she's genuinely leftist or progressive or whatever term one wants to apply to that, is also questionable. You know, that if there's, I think that this would demonstrate right there that if the battle within the Democrats is that she would represent, you know, a sort of a leftist point of view, then that's already a sorry state of affairs, because she has actually been rather supportive of the whole concept, for example, of the war on terrorism. And she actually did say, when the whole issue was brought up about whether or not President Bush should be impeached for crimes against humanity, she said, basically, it's not on the table. I forget her exact words, but I believe she used that expression, it's not on the table, that she would not even consider the possibility of holding an investigation about any of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in terms of, in general, let's say investigating what may have really happened with September 11th, she's actually fought vehemently against reopening any investigations and has not been supportive of Conyers or Kucinich or any of the other Congress members who actually truly are leftist and truly have wanted to investigate these things.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But otherwise, no. I mean, within the Democratic Party, I'd say that how would one want to put it? There's a certain kind of, I don't know if realpolitik is exactly the correct term to apply to them, but the people like the Madeleine Albrights, for example, or the Joe Bidens, you know, who really are very supportive of, you know, when Eisenhower introduced that phrase, the military-industrial complex, that is who they are. That is what they support.
So there will be no change to vis-à-vis this military-industrial complex, I guess.
Well, that seems highly unlikely. I mean, when Obama spoke at the Democratic Convention, when he first accepted his party's nomination, because, you know, there's that whole formal procedure there, he made it quite clear that, let's say, in terms of industry and in terms of industry's relationship to climate change, he made it quite clear that he would support the same range of technologies that have proven to be, you know, disastrous. And, you know, he was not talking about embracing alternatives to any serious degree. There may have been some lip service, but he indeed was talking about commitment to things such as clean coal, where how coal can be clean has still not been explained adequately. Likewise, safe nuclear power, and again, how we can trust that to be safe.
It's the same thing in our country with the open veil there with the liberals in our country.
Well, exactly. And in terms of, you know, military commitments, it's been made clear as well that Obama is not so much a critic of the war on terrorism as an event that is something to be pursued. his criticism is more that it's been mismanaged, right?
Mm, yes.
But the basic policies and behind all that, and as well as, of course, cornerstones such as a very firm commitment to Israel as an ally and.
Oh. You are disappearing. Yes.
No, sorry. No, we're okay. That's part of the chaos around me is
yes,
2.5 years.
Yes. You're a babysitter.
Exactly. Right. So if there's strange sound effects in the background, that's what's going on here.
Yeah. Right. Little Cedric is having fun.
Exactly. On the radio.
Yeah. Yeah. Will he pull the troops back out of Iraq and concentrate on Afghanistan, for instance, or is this merely lip service, as you put it?
Well, I'm fairly sure, I'll put it this way, that he will do something about that. That Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo Bay, these places will be presumably closed down, and that large numbers of troops presumably will withdraw from Iraq, but that's not the same thing. It's playing around with words, because that's not the same thing as a complete withdrawal from Iraq. Mm-hmm. I think troops left behind to defend American industrial interests there,
but not that big, not the fat guys sitting in a compound and not pulling out.
Well, exactly. And besides, one has to remember that there's a whole range of options that the U.S. has. If we only think in terms of the military and the CIA, we're forgetting all the other agencies. We're forgetting about mercenaries that the U.S. government regularly employs. There are plenty of ways to have a very strong military presence there with a whole range of agencies that are not going to be familiar to most of us, but represent the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, 5 years ago you did some cabaret-like performances about the role of Halliburton.
Yes.
What's now the role of Halliburton? Will be the same? Will be the relationship Cheney will be gone away? All those neocons will.
That's a very good question. I'm not entirely sure which other players there would be. Again, with Halliburton, certainly they're one of their subsidiaries, Kellogg, Brown, and Root, I think they're called, have been the main ones on the ground currently in Iraq. And again, so many of the corporations in the U.S. have interlocking boards, and so many, it's like a shell game with all the subsidiaries involved. Mm-hmm. So I would imagine it would be easy enough to make it appear that Halliburton has withdrawn. But whether or not that would truly be the case, as well as they do have competitors. There's a corporation called Bechtel, which is also a key player. So, even if Halliburton were to be squeezed out, that's something that we're going to have to wait and see. But if the large pieces of the pie just get redistributed to similar type corporations with similar type records on human rights abuses, despoiling the environment and just in general being economically corrupt, then again, it can sound like we have reason to cheer if we only read the headlines. But if we bother to look deeper, I suspect that, I think it's fair to look at the Clinton record with all of this and to see, who was servicing, providing the services for U.S. troops when we were involved in the campaign in Serbia. And I believe that was Bechtel, for example, at the time.
That's more the Democratic Halliburton.
Yes, exactly.
Now, let's focus us at length today also in the newspapers about the campaign itself. This Plouffe guy, David Plouffe, and Mr. Axelrod, who are these persons? What are they doing there? Who managed this successful campaign?
Well, in terms of what their...
How did the campaign work? Why was it successful?
Right. Well, for one thing, they raised, I mean, look, every 4 years we'll hear the same headlines. You know,
time for some campaigning.
Yeah, the most expensive campaign in history. I mean, that presumably we'll hear that again in 4 years from now. But what these guys were certainly successful with for Obama was raising unbelievable sums of money by not accepting public financing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, in theory, the idea is that the candidates, when they accept public financing, then on the one hand, yeah, the taxpayers contributing to their campaigns, but on the other hand, there are limitations as to how much money they're allowed to be raised. And Obama, actually, one would have assumed ordinarily, would have seen this as, something progressive in that sense that it's these laws exist to send the message that candidates are not, in the hip pocket of corporations. I mean, of course, they have their ways to do that anyway. But sure, no, the Obama campaign raised, I don't know.
Well, there's a lot of money.
But really a lot of money, which enabled him to really stay in the limelight throughout the campaign, including, and this was very clever, of course, not only in the obvious states like Ohio and Florida, the ones that are known as battleground states, but really, really throughout, to the point where, the McCain people were left sort of in the position where they were just trying to compare what Obama with Paris Hilton or something as some sort of, media darling. But no, but these guys were extremely good at raising raising money.
But also they managed to get a lot of people out of to vote.
Yeah.
And also young people. We had an interview last week on the same radio show with a guy from Acorn. It was formerly, I didn't know about of this. It's a civil movement for poor people and middle class people to get them houses but they get them also out to vote. What is, you know about this Acorn organization?
Actually, I have to say, the name is, I'm familiar with, but I'm not really familiar with who they are. Mm-hmm. But it is true that, 4 years ago, in the Democratic primary, I'm forgetting his name for a moment, but before John Kerry, of course, was triumphant, it actually, when it was more of a battle, there was, from New England, there was this guy who then went on to become chairman of the Democratic National Committee, but forgetting his name, but he was the first one to really, exploit's not the right word, but to benefit from the internet and how that really is a good way to stir up a grassroots moment and, as you're saying, to get young people, for example, really excited. And sure, with Obama, now he was being described at a certain point as the first internet candidate, but I assume that, more accurately, that would be after getting the nomination. And it is true that when Obama was running against Hillary Clinton, that one of the reasons why it seemed clear that he was able to defeat her, which at first seemed astonishing that he could pull that off, was indeed using the internet far more intelligently. I remember visiting both websites, for both candidates and being astonished at, how good his website was and how sort of traditional hers was, with just like the candidate posing in front of a flag with a fake smile. In other words, it could be from the far right just as well as an allegedly progressive party, whereas the Obama one really sort of projected, helped create his mystique, this idea that he's rises above partisan politics and, represents some sort of, truly 21st century visionary kind of...
Yes, that kind of stuff. For me, he has also something religious about it.
Yes.
About him and about his entourage and the way he communicates. He's... I have the speech here. Maybe we can listen later in the program. Parts of it. It's 17 minutes or something. This acceptance speech in Chicago.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yes. Okay.
But that's not now. But we're gonna after this interview. We're gonna list for our listeners who did not visit YouTube already.
Right. Okay.
This is YouTube quality, so it's not that good.
Yeah. Okay. But still.
But. Mm-hmm. So, but his speech was very well written.
Yes.
It was very sober. Can
yes.
you comment on that? The way he speeches, the way he communicates?
Well, I think he's... I mean, you know, I was talking about the fact that he... about his intellect, but on the emotional level, yes, he's very good. You know, he speaks... He speaks very well. I mean,
about this old woman, 106 years old, who
right.
cast the vote, and about his children. And he says, "Yeah, you earned your puppy for the White House."
Yes,
that's very clever. Huh?
Well, it's very clever, but it's funny because one of the alarming things right away about Obama is he's said on several occasions that he has a special admiration for Ronald Reagan, and the thing is, on the one hand. You know, it's not only because of the color of his skin. You know, Obama does have, I'm not going to say it's exactly the same, but, you know, he can be as moving at times as Martin Luther King, you know, in terms of just, it's more than eloquence. You know, there's certain kind of emotional impact.
Charismatic.
Right. But the reason I mention Reagan, you know, I'm not trying to compare Reagan and King as human beings, but in terms of anecdotes like that about, you know, there's this old lady, you know, in Georgia and bringing up puppy dogs and stuff like that, those are classic Reagan techniques, right, to really try to, you know, bring it down to, you know, an earthy kind of personal level, but then, of course, immediately it's a symbol for the nation, right? And,
yeah.
and Reagan was always... sort of like, you know, trying to come across as, you know, a dad from the 50s with his little anecdotes that are going to teach us a moral lesson.
Yeah. But also, I thought also he was leaning to Roosevelt and to Churchill, especially when his socio-economical things are involved. Even today in newspapers already, he wants to face the economical crisis,
yes.
facing the earth, facing United States and Europe.
Well, actually, it's funny.
What's he going to do?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting when you mention Roosevelt. I mean, on the one hand, this was probably part of the basis for the Republicans claiming that Obama is some sort of, you know, undercover socialist because, you know, they made those kinds of accusations about Roosevelt. But what's he going to do? I mean, he has so far...
But Mr. Warren Buffett is a financier of high level. He's sitting on the board.
Well, exactly. I mean, his interests... I mean, in terms of who's his real constituency, it's clearly extremely rich and powerful people. And it seems clear enough that you know, in terms of how progressive would he be, well, the idea is... Again, the big charge against Bush is mismanagement, not in terms of we actually need fundamental structural change and that we need to, you know, rethink how we conduct business.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, someone like Warren Buffett, you know, is a great example of someone who, on the one hand, you know, his admirers are saying,
also,
yeah, you know, he doesn't follow all these unstable trends. You know, he goes with, you know, the true, solid, you know, old-timey investments. But those are all, you know, these multinational corporations that actually are quite awful. But, you know, it's just that they're stable, you know.
Yeah. They're also hip, happy people like Eric Schmidt. It's a guy from the CEO from Google. He's also on the ticket.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, of course, I mean, Clinton was someone who was also a big friend to people like that, to, you know, really pushing the e-commerce, right? And much as I would...
And the dot-com bubble.
Well, exactly. And I think even though it's you know... apparent what the shortcomings of George Bush have been, and you know how what the consequences have been. I think one has to realize that it's not like he entered a situation that was wonderful and then destroyed it. You know that some of his policies were continuing Clinton, such as like you're saying, the sort of bubble. Type philosophy, you know, let's forget about tomorrow kind of attitude.
Also, will there be a new deal? Something like that, like investing in fundraising for infrastructure, which I understood that in the United States is a little bit messy.
Right.
Schooling, housing, healthcare, big infrastructure, roads. Right. I guess I'm going at the end of this month. I'm going to the United States. Yes, I am going to the Southeast. So,
right.
So I'm wondering, will there be something like a new deal?
That I'm not really, I guess, prepared to make a prediction. But I mean. That would presumably be something Obama could do that would be very positive, because as you're saying, so much of America is falling apart at the seams. And the truth is, any kind of policy that would both, you know, try to repair the infrastructure and at the same time.
Yes. For instance, it's a little bit like a joke, but mm-hmm. I didn't know that, but I realized there's still 110 volts in the United States. We have 240 or something in Europe, right?
Mm-hmm.
The electricity system.
Right.
For instance, to renovate that. That's what exactly Mr. Roosevelt did.
Right. Well, that, I mean, what can I say? I mean, all those things need to be looked into deeply. I mean, you know, apart from what happened in New Orleans, I mean, the other major disaster that really called attention to how serious things are is when that bridge collapsed in Minnesota, I think. And, you know, just collapsed not because of an earthquake or anything like that, but just because it was in a bad state of disrepair. It was, you know, that kind of situation. And then, you know, headlines that exists across the U.S. There are, you know, creaking bridges ready to collapse all over the place, including, you know, for example, in New York where I come from. So, no, I mean, stuff like that, of course, well, I say of course, I mean, potentially could be great, although what would be really interesting would be, you know, when Roosevelt was president, of course, there was no understanding yet of what was going on with the environment, and any kind of, you know, new deal in the U.S., one would hope would have to be mm-hmm. some sort of a Green New Deal.
Though, Green, you know, New Deal.
Exactly. Building, I mean, on the one hand, I'm not saying this is the answer. It's one of, you know, a thousand or more things that needs to be done. But, you know, building windmills and things like that, which, you know, you have in Europe. But
yes.
But in the U.S., I think we're lagging behind, you know, pathetically.
Now, from a broader perspective, there was a lot of fuss with Kenya and Africa in general.
Mm-hmm.
Black or colored people in office in the United States means a lot to them.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an illusion for them, or is this a dream come true?
I certainly don't think it's a dream come true. I mean, I can understand, of course, symbolically it is important, but in terms of what a President Obama's policies would be, you know, in terms of, for example, you know, what's going on in Congo right now, and, mm-hmm. you know, as we know, it's not only factionalism, you know, and vendettas that are going on, that a lot of that...
it's about money.
It's about money, right.
And about coltan.
Exactly. What would Obama's policies be there, or what would Obama's policies be in Somalia with this, you know, mm-hmm. support of government? Well, of crooks, exactly, of a government it's basically a government in name only, but it's like the fig leaf to try to, you know, keep you know, any kind of Islamic movement from, you know, nationalist Islamic movement, you know, the assumption that all Islamic movements are terrorist and, you know, going ahead with policies based on that assumption. So I can't say that I know, but I mean, there's no reason, you know, Obama's given no signs that I'm aware of that he would have more progressive attitudes towards Africa.
How did we're going to close this conversation in a few moments?
Yeah.
But how did your family and friends over in the United States react personally?
as far as I know, well, certainly my family are thrilled. You know, they're both thrilled because
we saw people on television. We saw people dancing, singing, right. having fun about this.
Well, exactly. I mean, well, let me put it this way. This is kind of interesting. When was this? About 3 years ago, something like that. I was in Berlin for a family reunion for my father's side of the family, and his family come from Texas, going back many generations. And although my father is very intelligent and, let's say, certainly not leftist, but at least left of center kind of person. But he's always been like the black sheep of the family, right? The others have been real proud Republicans, you know, people who saw Clinton as some sort of, you know, Fidel Castro or God knows what, you know. But the point is, what was interesting, because one of the odd things is sometimes people, you can like them on a personal level, even though you despise their, you know, political ideas, you know. So getting together with them, and I'm talking about people a good deal older than I am, you know, and sitting back at night drinking whiskey and so on, they actually had completely changed their minds about a range of things. It's not like they'd become leftists, but they hated Bush so much that they began to even sound like revolutionaries themselves. I mean, yeah. This one big cousin of mine who's, you know, this guy around 70 who's really tall and fat and like this big bear of a Texan type guy was really talking about things like, how are we going to get this guy out of office? I mean, it practically sounded like he was ready to pick up a gun and take care of business himself. So,
real American spirit.
Well, yeah. But I think a lot of people, what they may say they're celebrating Obama's victory, but I think what they're really celebrating is the end of an era, yeah. The end of a horrific era.
Maybe the last rephrasing question, how will be the relationship with the European governments? There's a lot of conservative, even in our own country, there's a conservative government. Labour is not doing very well in England. France has a conservative government. So Berlusconi said, hey, he's a nice guy. He has got everything going for him. He's sentenced.
Well,
what do we have to expect with the relationship with Europe?
I have to assume that that Europeans overall, no matter what their political philosophy, have been for the last several months more or less, you know, getting down on their knees, you know, begging America to elect Obama rather than McCain. And I think that people like the Berlusconis, you know, and other, Sarkozy, you know, people like that, that for them, the idea is that Obama is at least someone we can do business with. You know, he's at least someone who is intelligent, who isn't going to, you know, mismanage things, who isn't going to, be the puppet for these Dr. Strangelove type people like Dick Cheney and so on, and Karl Rove and the cast of characters. And, we saw when Tony Blair was in office, for example, someone who was, you know, there are a few nice things one can say, you know, about certain progressive things. But by and large, of course, we saw that he, created this new labor by basically, pulling out its teeth and embracing a lot of, you know, very conservative policies. Mm-hmm. So in terms of, you know, would Obama be exactly the same? I'm not saying that, but I just think that a whole range of people in Europe are going to say, well, at least we've got someone we can talk with now.
Because there is a neo-Keynesian shift, governments buying banks and so on, of supporting banks and financial institutions. So there will be some kind of new deal, we can conclude.
Yeah, that. I think so. I think that more or less
neocon and neoliberal politics will be
Yes, exactly. I think that's a very accurate description that you're giving.
Yeah. Okay. Michael, where did you cast your vote? Was it in an embassy or in consulate?
No, it's called absentee ballot. It's a very old-fashioned system where you get this sort of yellowish
paper. I saw this voting things in the United States. It amazed me for a superpower, for technology and so on, and then the old-fashioned way of voting.
Yeah, it is. You know what? That is amazing. I mean, again, like in New York, they still have these incredible voting booths, each one of which weighs something like a ton, and, you know, with this old-fashioned curtain, and these things go back to, I don't know, Vietnam War era or something like that. And so, it's astonishing. But again, in terms of, you know, it's such a powerful country, and yet there's no investment in infrastructure unless, you know...
See, that's an example.
Well, yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much, Michael Laird, for your comment on this presidential election.
Well,
and I see you soon.
Yes. Okay, terrific.
Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.